Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, hello, Kamie the Fulcher, and 100,000 welcomes to you, all of you, to the Indie Football Podcast. I am Ed Mallion, and we have a fairly busy old show for you this week with a focus on the big game from Sunday, Chelsea's 2-1 win over Tottenham at Wembley, but also touching on every Premier League game, a brief look at La Liga, which got underway this weekend, and a glance ahead to the Champions League draw. But I am nowhere near equipped to address so many issues of such importance on my own, and thus I have drafted in a couple of my nearest and dearest to help me break this all down. So today, rising above the noise, we have the man, the legend, the double-barreled weapon. It's Jack Pitbrook.
Good afternoon, Ed.
Good afternoon to you, Jack. And finally, please allow me to present Miguel Delaney to you, Chief Football Writer of The Independent. Miguel, hello.
Hello.
How was your weekend?
Yep, good. Especially after that Irish welcome, after over half a decade in London, I finally feel truly welcome.
There are many football podcasts, but few as culturally aware, and that's why we toss in the Gaelic.
Irish, you'd call it, really.
Irish, yeah, Irish, yeah. Sorry. Apologies for that.
So you welcome as being in O'Neill's on Wardour Street.
Yeah, or the Swan.
or the Swan in Stockwell, if you've never been. You two in front of me, Jack and Miguel, you were both at Wembley on Sunday for Tottenham-Chelsea. So this feels pretty obviously like the best place to start. The first clash of the season between two of last season's top four, and indeed last season's top two, if I remember correctly. Marcus Alonso got the opening goal. Michy Batshuayi's weird time in West London continued with a brilliantly taken own goal. But Chelsea prevailed with a late winner. So, Miguel, you start us off. What's the biggest thing that we are taking away from this game?
Well, I remember as myself and Jack were sitting there 3 minutes from the end trying to work out our intros, we were kind of discussing what's actually the bigger story here. Is it Tottenham's Wembley jinx, or supposed jinx, or the champions avoiding a crisis? And I think probably in the long term it's the latter, actually, because I mean, given the amount of problems Chelsea had going into this game, and I before the match, I was wondering how to avoid defeat. So to win it like that, okay, they weren't necessarily their best, it was quite a constrained performance. You know, there's been a few accusations about whether it was negative or that, but I think it was. The fact there's been so many parallels brought up between 2 years ago, and even after the game, Courtois was speaking in the mix zone, and so he specifically mentioned 2 years ago, more so the fact that for their second game in 2015, it was away to Manchester City, who had also, just like Spurs, been the second place team the previous season, and they got wiped out, whereas this time the opposite happened. And I think it is. It genuinely shows that there are more different, or many more differences to 2015. I think you wouldn't have seen a rally like we did against Burnley last week. I mean, you wouldn't have seen this kind of, as Conte put it, the spirit laid on.
Yeah, I mean, it was clearly a tactical masterclass from Antonio Conte. It's strange to think that looking, you know, before the game, it felt as if he was almost on his last legs as Chelsea manager. Mm-hmm. And then he comes up with this new system, this sort of 3-5-2, which is basically, a lot of the time, was a 5-4-1, which was an incredibly effective way of shutting down Tottenham. I think what I fear from Tottenham's perspective is that in that game, we saw the seeds of what we might see at other times this season, which is, on that big Wembley pitch, teams flooding the middle, Spurs have to go wide. Mm-hmm. But without Kyle Walker, and in this instance, without Danny Rose, I didn't think they had the pace or the incision out wide to get around the sides.
It is, I mean, for all the talk about Spurs and whether they can take the next step and Wembley and all this, I think that is one of their biggest issues, that there's an occasional bluntness to the team. I mean, even Kane said afterwards, we had 8-9 chances, nothing to worry about. But even most of those chances are actually, okay, his shot to hit the post, but still that's kind of him cutting in, trying to do something special from the edge of the box. And then loads of kind of just flashed crosses, which is what we've seen from Spurs in a lot of these sort of big games.
Yeah, I think there's a legitimate criticism to make of Tottenham, which is that while they're so compelling to watch when they're on it, particularly when they're throwing everyone forward, they don't really, I mean, they're not like Manchester City, who create very good chances by cutting through teams. A lot of it is, you know, throwing the ball into the box, pushing and pushing and pushing, and eventually overwhelming the opponents with energy.
But usually they have Kane, who can suddenly make a run out of nowhere to finish.
Exactly. But, you know, if you're playing against a really well-organised, effectively a back five, like we saw on Sunday, then I think sometimes Tottenham lack the, you know, that kind of extra edge to create the high-quality chance.
That was the thing as well. I think, you know, obviously in December, or in January, Dele Alli scored twice against Chelsea. Then he scored again in the FA Cup. And this was obviously something that Conte had looked at as well, because he gave I think David Luiz's specific instructions apparently were to kind of track the runs of Eriksen and particularly Dele Alli. And we saw in this game that they didn't get the same sort of openings.
And indeed, you wrote something about David Luiz's role today. You can read that on independent.co.uk/football. And roughly what was the thrust of that piece? You felt that David Luiz stepped into that midfield role with great aplomb.
Yeah.
And you think that could change their plans for the rest of this window and possibly for the rest of the season?
I mean, it was a very specific role for a very specific game. But certainly, David Luiz has played in that position before. And he hasn't been as kind of influential as he has been here. He's always been a bit more, I suppose, a trend of his second spell at Chelsea, that whereas previously he used to be an effective player but a very erratic one, that kind of erratic part of his game is almost gone. I think that's down to the way Conte coached him. Even Luis spoke after the game about how the specific runs he was told to make, and obviously he can fulfil that role for Conte. And I think, it is causing a little bit of reconsideration at Chelsea, and particularly with Conte, over the transfer plans. I mean, they still want four players. One of those has been a midfielder with Danny Drinkwater, but they're not going to get Danny Drinkwater less than 40 million, which you would say is like questionable maybe for players. Not
feels a touch expensive.
Yeah, for a player who's not going to meet, who you wouldn't think is going to immediately drop into your first team. But I think they could reassess and maybe switch attention to Van Dijk, because that story's not completely finished yet, despite Southampton's stance. But obviously Van Dijk would then become first choice centre half if they got him, and David Luiz would be someone who kind of, you know, shifts between the two.
What's interesting for me, obviously a lot of games at this point of the season get seen through the transfer lens, because it's something that you can still address once we're out the transfer window, that you can't add or take away players. So it's more about what you can do with the squad you've got, and that is a different sort of aspect to the manager's skill set, I guess. Marcus Alonso was important in this win. When he arrived and it was kind of like, oh yeah, remember he was on loan at Bolton and et cetera, et cetera. And then he had a great season last year, an important part on the left of Chelsea's switch to the 3-4-3. What are the implications for him? Because Chelsea haven't been shy in looking to upgrade him.
Yeah.
Alexandro is, what, £70 million worth of player, they're saying now.
Do we necessarily think it's an upgrade, or is it more that...
You need two of them.
Yeah, you need... It's like that's the issue that... Pochettino's had at Spurs as well, because there's such a burden on the fullbacks now running, you need two, and Chelsea don't have that. So if Alonso, and we saw it last week with Moses is out, then they're completely lacking as a team. So he does need four wingbacks in total.
Yeah, I mean, a lot on the subject of the time in the transfer window, Alonso is actually a really good example of why sometimes it's beneficial to start the season before the window shuts.
Yeah,
in the sense that last year Chelsea didn't really know what they wanted. Then they started the season, and towards the end of the window, Conte realized, hold on a second, we need another centre back who can play in a three and a proper left wing back, because we don't really have one. They signed Luiz and Alonso, and they were two of the most important players to win the league.
So that's the direct opposite of kind of what everyone's been saying for the last week.
I think it's I can see why people say, oh, we must stop the window in the middle of August before the season. But in reality, I think, particularly in the next kind of 8 or 9 days, we'll see lots of teams who've played their first two games thought, Christ, hold on a second, we don't have a right back.
And that happens so often.
Yeah, we got this guy in, but he's actually useless.
Yeah.
And then they'll go back into the market. And that's why after the early August dip, which I think we've now had, there's going to be quite a lot of activity in the next week as teams fill gaps which have only just become apparent to them.
The other side of this debate as well is, I mean, and I think it's relevant to this all the Chelsea kind of crisis stuff, but I mean, so much been made of Conte and his disgruntlement with transfers, but I think it's easy to forget he was actually exactly the same last August in his first summer for Chelsea. He didn't get any of the first choice players he wanted, but then once the window closed, he basically just looked at what he had, reassessed and reconfigured. And I don't think there's a manager in the Premier League at the moment who is as good at doing that as he is. And I think it is a massive advantage for Chelsea still.
Tactically, he's always been very astute. We've seen that in every single job he's done. That Italy team he had at the Euros was... I was doing the opening game, and the Italian journalists were saying this is the worst Italy squad since the 1950s. And that first game, they blew away Belgium, who were kind of one of the really fancy teams for this competition. He did get Bakayoko, who made his debut. Mm. What did you make of Bakayoko in his first appearance?
I think probably hard. I mean, it wasn't kind of like a performance he had in Monaco. It was a little bit hard to judge him because of the nature of the game. But he was solid. I can't remember anything he did wrong, which in a match like that is pretty much all he could do.
I mean, I didn't think he looked fully fit, but the first thing he did after about 7 seconds was flatten Moussa Dembélé, which is actually quite difficult to do.
No, it is hard to do. Yeah. It's like running into a wall.
So, yeah, I mean, clearly he's not up to speed yet, but equally he's a really good player. We saw from Monaco last season, and I'm sure that once he's slotted in, he probably gives them a more physically aggressive player than Nemanja Matic would be, which is why Conte prefers him.
I feel we've discussed Conte. I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts, Jack, on Pochettino. Did he get anything wrong necessarily, or were they just beaten? Occasionally, you do the right thing, but you just end up losing to a superior team. Or do you think that there are different ways he could have gone about this game?
Well, yeah, I mean, that is the big question. I wasn't that impressed with Spurs, even though they did dominate the game. I didn't think they really did enough to win it. Could they have done it any differently? I'm not sure. I mean, it's not a great bench. You know, they had on the bench Heung-min Son, Moussa Sissoko, Vincent Janssen, Kevin Vimmer.
Crikey. I mean,
yeah, like the big issue with Spurs is, and this has been an issue for a few years now, is that they need a better winger because they don't have one. But they have been reluctant to spend the money on a top winger, which is why they've gone for, what you might call Europa League level wingers, like Clinton and Gee and Georges Kevin and Kudu.
And a lot of Spurs attacking ultimately comes down to what seems like a template. So it feels like they need someone to just go outside at the odd time, make them less predictable, and to do the unpredictable.
Yeah, I mean, that explains why for so long they've really wanted Wilfried Zaha. Mm. They've not been able to get him, I think in part because, he would want big money and Crystal Palace would want it. More money than Tottenham would be willing to spend. But it's kind of the problem if you have a coach like Pochettino who is that systematic and who has such a clear idea about how he wants the game to be played, like introducing a little bit of imagination or flexibility or basically thinking beyond the constraints of that
system. Alan Pardew used to call the chaos.
Yeah, like yeah. that's kind of the dilemma of coaching attacking football, basically. Yeah.
And it's interesting to me because it's a discussion we had the other week about Mourinho's coaching of attacking is in that he kind of gets good attackers in and he kind of lets them do what they want.
Yeah, completely.
He doesn't militarily coach them. And
Bar on the defensive side.
But in attack. Zaha is exactly that, and kind of Yannick Bolasie before him, those sort of guys who, it's almost like they don't even know what they're going to do next. So how on earth can the managers know what they're going to do next? And I agree, looking at Spurs, I think sometimes there is a slightly sterile aspect to them where you're basically expecting Dele Alli to produce a wonder goal or Christian Eriksen to pick the perfect pass. Fortunately, they're both very good. They're both very capable of doing that. But if they could sign someone who is capable of just beating two men, basically what it is, and that's what Zaha brings, it is... You can stand him up against a player one-on-one, and he's probably one of the best players in the Premier League, if not the best player in the Premier League at doing that. And their interest in him is obviously dead because, apart from anything, he signed a new contract and he's injured now. But I'd be interested to see what Spurs can do at the end of the window. Traditionally, it's their best time. It's their most busy time, Jack. But do you expect them to get a real difference maker, or are they just going to be fishing in what you, as you described, kind of a Europa League bargain bin?
Well, I mean, it depends how you would classify Ross Barkley. I've thought all summer that he will end up at Spurs probably around on deadline day for in and around 20-25 million. I'd imagine they'll get a kind of higher profile attacking player than that. There's obviously a few players like Balde abroad who they have an interest in who might be able to give them a bit extra, but even then you wonder if they're perhaps closer to the kind of Nkudu level than to the top level. And so I don't imagine that we'll see like very different attacking personnel at Tottenham from what they currently have. And even Barkley, I think ultimately, I think we might have discussed this before, is someone who I think would more likely play in a deeper central role for Tottenham rather than further up out wide.
Yeah.
No. Someone who could become like a Moussa Dembélé,
I think so, yeah.
More style of midfielder. And Miguel Chelsea, I mean, Conte's been very outspoken that they wanted more guys. You said about the David Luiz thing, could that change their plans? What do we really think they're going to get done in the next, less than 10 days now?
Yeah, it feels like it's a bit too short a spell to bring in that many players. I'd imagine two or three. I said 2 weeks ago in this pod, I think that if they got two or three players, they'd actually be my favourites. And given... almost both the psychological effect of Sunday's win and everything it represented, I'd nearly have them to win the title again. I know it feels like so drastic to go from one to the other like that, but I think it was a very creditable win in that sense. And if they can add to the squad, and let's not forget the players they're already missing from this game as well.
So you fancy Chelsea for the title, but it is Manchester United who are top of the league after another 4-0 victory, this time against Swansea City. Eric Bailly had them in front just before half-time. but then three goals in 4 late minutes from the Francophone trio, Paul Pogba, Anthony Martial and Romelu Lukaku, sealed a big win. Are they back?
They're very, very impressive. And it does look, I mean, from this juncture, I think it'd be quite, it would take anyone brave to say they're not going to challenge, and I'm not going to say that. There's two caveats. First of all, they started last season very well also. Secondly, I would just wonder about the quality of the teams they're playing. And I know that's, you can only beat what's in front of you and all that, but I think there is a genuine context here, because I think West Ham have a massive problem under Bilic. I mean, myself and Jack were talking off air before, but I mean, we've heard separately from, I tweeted this out on Saturday actually, I heard separately from people at two of the top six clubs that they described West Ham as tactically the worst team in the Premier League. So like, and you could see United just, you know, rush through them throughout the whole game. The Swansea, I thought United's first half performance was much more like last season until they finally got the goal, and then Swansea had to change something. So that would, I think they were very, very good. And clearly, once a game breaks, United, like, they won't have anywhere near as many draws last season. That by definition will put them much higher up the table, get them much closer to a title challenge, and they probably will challenge. But there may be still a question about what happens in those games where they don't break teams down.
Do you think that undoing will be against the big teams? I mean, I know in the Super Cup against Real Madrid, they got close at the end, but the first hour they barely touched the ball. I mean, you know, City, Chelsea, Liverpool, Tottenham aren't as good as Real Madrid, but they are good.
Yeah.
Do you think United have got the right approach for the big games?
It's going to be interesting, because I think one thing Mourinho did last season, actually, he was very much more defensive than usual. In fact, it was actually a lot like Chelsea 2013-14, when he didn't really have all his players in. And I think the real reason for that was he didn't have someone like Matic, he didn't have a defensive midfielder he wanted. So it meant the whole team had to sit much deeper back. And that was particularly the case in the nil-all against City towards the end of the season. I don't think he'll do that again, unless he's in a situation like, actually, do you remember when he sealed the title with Chelsea against Palace, the 1-0?
Yes,
and they basically ended with 7-7 defending. Unless it's one of those games where he knows, we lock this down now, we do it. I think United will be more progressive against bigger teams. And they're interesting to watch in that sense. Some of us might have to write a few mea culpas about Mourinho if we do.
Well, they're rarely this devastating in attack. Mm. You say they're just facing poor teams. The context of the Swansea game was, with 10 minutes to go, they're only 1-0 up. So Swansea have to push, and they score three goals in a few minutes, and the whole thing falls apart. Do you think we might see Mourinho just try and win the title, basically blocking out the games against the top six, and then just trying to beat all the, you know, you said about Lukaku being a flat track bully. Is that not the way that United could actually win the title?
Yeah, it was obviously United's massive problem last season, and most champions, they do the business against the bottom 14, if you like. That's a necessity. But you still need to... I mean, most of the champions last few years had at least a 50-50 record against the rest of the top six, as is the nature of it. Just trying to think the United's record in games against the top six last season, up until the Chelsea game, actually, with the 2-0 win, which was very impressive. Their actual record against the rest of the top six wasn't that impressive.
What do you think about Paul Pogba and the possibility that having Nemanja Matic there will allow him not just to attack more, but also perhaps to play in a two rather than have to play further up as a 10?
Yeah, because it just releases him. And that's what... This is the key with Pogba. I mean, he's a player that, to really maximise his gifts, he almost needs to kind of be off the cuff, be allowed to try things, be allowed... And I think, for all the criticism he gets, I actually think he's quite a responsible player, in the sense that if he's given a defensive role, he's actually very disciplined, tries to stick to it. But it means that then you don't see the real Pogba.
It does take its toll on his attacking output, basically. I think we've seen that a few times with him, because, you know, sometimes to his own detriment, he follows these instructions very, very closely.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
He obviously admires Mourinho. You know, there is something there in that relationship between them. What do you think about Anthony Martial? People talking about him coming out of this game. Obviously, there was some interest from other clubs this summer, not least into Milan and Tottenham. Martial looks likely to stay there, I think we'd say.
Yeah.
People getting a bit carried away with him becoming, you know, this big guy. Do you not think that basically him and Rashford are going to have a timeshare arrangement this season?
There's probably a little bit of that, actually. But I think it's encouraging for Martial from the perspective that Mourinho's always been a bit cold on him. He's publicly criticised him. He's privately considered selling him the odd time, but it's never quite gone far enough. Like, it's one of those things I think that's kind of thrown out there, but never a concrete decision made. And also, the United hierarchy would be very, very reluctant to ever sell Martial, just because he's such a young player. He's got such precocious talent, and also he's very popular commercially and with fans. But I think this could be To be fair, the other side of it is maybe a little bit of the penny has to drop with Martial as well. Even though we can criticise all we like Mourinho's demands on wingers, and we tend to be primarily defensive than attacking, if you are in a Mourinho team, you have to adapt a bit, and that's, I think, Martial's maybe been looking to do that. So if you can marry those two aspects of his game, then he can go on a level. But there are some times you watch Martial and I think, I suppose we got to see it against Swansea just because of the nature of the match. But you just let him play, you know. let him flourish.
He just needs a bit of space.
Yeah, because he's so smooth.
Jack, they are top of the table, Manchester United, but there are two other teams that have won both of their games. As we'd all expected, Huddersfield, 100% from their first two. Aaron Moy showing just how two-footed he is in the opening couple of games this season. A brilliant right-footed strike. But they do look like prime candidates for regression. They haven't dominated either of these games. The expected goals, which is something the BBC are now using. You're allowed to talk about it in public. Didn't work. But Newcastle with another defeat, I think, spelling trouble for Mike Ashley rather than Rafa, do you think?
Well, I'd say trouble with whom? Like, clearly Rafa is far more popular with the Newcastle fans than Ashley is. Clearly Rafa feels very let down by the lack of spending in the transfer market this summer. Whether this means that, you know, has Rafa been proven right by how bad Newcastle have been in the first two games? Maybe, because he would have said the team wasn't ready for the Premier League, and that's only been proven by the fact that clearly the team isn't good enough yet. But ultimately, you know, it is Ashley's money and Ashley's club. And if any of those, if either of those two men are to leave, it's going to be Rafa, not Ashley.
Absolutely. Well, we discussed before how the team does look. If you look at it just on paper, the players do look like an upper championship squad rather than anything else.
I think being a group of championship players is survivable.
Absolutely, yeah.
If you look at, the best two examples in the last few years are Bournemouth and Burnley. Like two groups of championship players, in lots of cases League One players, who came into the Premier League, but because they had a clear way of playing, a manager they believed in, a home ground which was slightly different perhaps from what other teams were used to, they managed to get enough home wins to survive. And that is both the Howe model and the Dyche model. But for Newcastle, for various different reasons, a lot of which I think boil down to the fact that it's not an unfamiliar place to go, and also it's not a happy club. Like, clearly there are so many tensions there. They can't recreate that kind of unity.
This is the thing, they are, in the words of the immortal words of AVB, in a negative spiral. But I think you can have a lot of sympathy for Benitez in the situation. But equally, I do think there's an issue in the sense that, and this is such a pattern from his career, he allows these problems to too easily bleed onto the pitch. And it's almost something he's like, they consume him sometimes more than actually doing the job he has at hand, which I suppose, and there's the classic counterexample that this weekend is Conte. I mean, he's had similar issues, given he's been complaining about the quality of the team, and yet he's still improvised. He still set the right mood for that game. He changed the mood from the Burnley match. And where was Benitez? I mean, he saw the exact same at Liverpool in 2009-10. Once there was that negativity coming in, kind of where it overtook any positive vibes, say, from promotion, it takes on a momentum of its own almost.
Well, and the problem with club politics like that is it does ultimately give the players an excuse.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's two sides of one's coin. On the one hand, you can say, or by talking about the off-the-field scenario, you've taken the pressure off the players. Mm. But on the other hand, you've told the players that you're losing because the board have got it wrong. And therefore, we all know that players are always willing to take the first excuse they're presented with.
Rafa, we said before, he's always been in this sort of guy where if you're not 100% for him, you're against him.
Yeah.
You know, you might...
And he's never wrong.
Someone
was going to...
Yeah, no, but he's very bloody-minded. And if he doesn't feel like he's got the full backing, then he does throw his toys out the pram a bit, and he's done it everywhere. And the interesting thing, like you're saying, is every club he's done this, except Real Madrid, where he was too scared to ever say anything out against Florentino Perez, even after Florentino Perez had sacked him and replaced him before even telling Rafa himself. And it is a shame, but there is something I almost weirdly admire about Mike Ashley, and the fact that he does seem to be completely unmoved by the supporters all the time. It's an astonishing kind of level of he's just so sure of himself. He has made billions and billions of pounds doing it his way, so fair enough. The other unbeaten team, Miguel, as you definitely didn't predict, West Brom. Tony Pulis beating his heir apparent Sean Dyche away at Burnley 1-0. Could it have been more Pulis to do it just 1-0? And West Brom already looking good to get to 40 points.
Yeah. Well, what's the percentage now? Six of 40.
So, yeah, it's roughly 19%-ish. Yeah.
But so high.
But they, you know, their problem last year was they got to 40 and they just stopped.
Mm.
Do you think there's anything Pulis can do to actually ensure that he takes the team to the next step? Or do you think it's just because he is briefed on expectations and as far as he's concerned, that literally is what his job is to do?
I'm not sure. Because I remember after, was it, Stoke City were in the Premier League for 2 years. Maybe it was a year, actually. And they signed Tunkai Sanli. And he thought, this is actually, well, that's not a Pulis player at all. It's someone that can actually give them something different. And yet, he was barely used then, or kind of, where Pulis didn't get out of him really. And I think it was almost like a pattern was set then, because I think even though Pulis maybe wants to break out, because obviously, I mean, like anyone else, he's got ambition, and he, you know, his friends like Mourinho talk about he should be at a bigger job and all this thing. But yet, you wonder when it comes right down to it, he can't stop himself allowing to take the risk that actually that is a necessity to go that extra level.
But West Brom, top of the table. Well, joint top anyway.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Stoke 1, Arsenal 0. Probably the biggest surprise result of the weekend. Is that fair to say, Jack Pitbrook?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, particularly after Arsenal beating Leicester in their opening game. And then all of a sudden, we're kind of back to this old scenario where they go to Stoke and the defensive problems are shown up. I think that, you know, it clearly wasn't like the first choice Arsenal back line. I think that it was not very difficult for Heze, who looked very impressive on his Stoke debut, to get in behind them. Again, Arsenal slightly exposed in not having a holding player with Granit Xhaka.
It's a midfield problem there,
yeah.
Isn't it, still?
I think it's a lot of it comes to the fact that Wenger settled on this 3-4-2-1 towards the end of last season. And, you know, it did work for them and it was effective, not least in the FA Cup final. But now they're, you know, new season starts all of a sudden.
Teams adapt.
They realise, oh, we know how to play against this, not least because everybody else in the league plays like it. And now Stoke Arsenal might have to reconsider.
Yeah. And also, I think maybe it was slightly overlooked because they won last week, but Leicester really found out how to hurt that system through the back. I mean, like, the amount of times Vardy got in behind, now, granted some of that's down to Vardy's pace, but they'd obviously seen something they could expose it with. And this is going to be the challenge for Wenger again now that, once this is regularly rumbled, he has to kind of slightly improvise himself or adapt again. Is he capable of a second adapt?
Yeah, I know. And this is the problem, was that this was Arsenal's first big like tactical change for literally years.
Yeah.
Having stuck with the 4-2-3-1 for a long time. And if this doesn't work out, then I'm not sure, would you back Wenger to tweak it in such a way as to make it?
I still think they're finishing sixth, which is what
And on the other side of that, obviously it's a big win for Stoke. Mainly because it might have bought Mark Hughes some time. He was the favourite to be the next manager to leave. He was struggling. Then he gets a win over a top six side on live TV, which is always much more impactful in terms of how you are perceived.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be, but it just is. It's just how things work. I felt that a little bit about Man City Everton on Monday night. Pep Guardiola, curiously, after a 1-1 draw where they got a late equaliser, said it was... What did he say? It was a massive result for him.
It was one of the proudest nights of his career.
One of the proudest nights of his career.
So happy.
Can you possibly explain to me why on earth that would be, Jack?
Well, I do think in the second half, City were really good. And, beating a team, you know, ultimately coming from 1-0 down and a man down at half-time to draw 1-1 in any game is pretty good. And I thought in the second half, City were much better than they were in the first half. They created a lot of chances. And on another day, they actually could have won 2 or 3-1. which says a lot for how well they played. I do think that, you know, even the red card notwithstanding, I thought that Guardiola got it wrong in the first half. For the second time this season, he started with a 3-5-2. My impression of 3-5-2 is it's a fudge to avoid having to choose between either Aguero or Gabriel up front. If he plays, because I don't think, I mean, we covered this in the previous podcast, but I don't think Pep trusts Aguero to play up front on his own. So he feels like he has to have Gabriel with him. But by doing that, he needs to play a 3-5-2, which means moving Leroy Sané, who's the best player for the second half of last season, out to left wing back, which isn't his natural position. Of course, it was Sané's slip up, which let in Everton for Rooney's goal. And it was only in the second half where City played, you know, what was kind of started off as a sort of 3-5-1 and then became a kind of 4-4-1 or a sort of 2-6-1 in the second half that City actually started to create chances. And I think Aguero played much better, to be honest, the second half when he didn't have Gabriel to worry about kind of occupying the same space. And in the second half, he was brilliant after a fairly ropey first half.
Sterling's late goal there, the equaliser, and it was a very nice finish, the volley. What do you think about Everton? They've got off to a half-decent start. Yeah.
Rooney looks very sharp.
Yeah, as you predicted, kind of. Everton are, interestingly, I think the first opposition team that Pep Guardiola has failed to beat within his first three league meetings as a manager in any league. And, you know, Ronald Koeman,
who played,
is there anything to do with the fact that he played with him?
Well,
what do you read into that?
Koeman literally played right behind him.
Yes.
But it's actually, I mean, for all this talk of kind of Koeman also being part of that Barca school, he's actually not at all. He's much more pragmatic than any of them. And even like the way he will, so his teams will be so much more pragmatic and defensive, you could say. In fact, you could almost say he's stylistically kind of the opposite to Guardiola.
He has an interesting mix of philosophies going on, but he's also... He's fiercely ambitious in terms of, you know, people that know him say that he is a guy who really, you know, his eyes are set on the Barca job and going as high as he can.
He's not
going
to get the Barcelona job playing the kind of football that Everton played yesterday. You know, with no disrespect to it, it was an effective way of getting the result. But, you know, that kind of football is not going to get you that job.
Yeah.
But I think he could do it. I mean, obviously, now they've got a lot of money. Mashiri is going to back this club. I think, you know, especially if you look down the line where they might get a new stadium, which, as we know, is kind of a game changer for clubs. They started this game with 8 English players as well. It's the first time they've done that in the Premier League since 1997. Really, that means nothing. But at the same time, it means a lot for the fans. And if you do have a homegrown core, I think, like Tottenham showed, it can help in some ways, Jack.
Yeah, and certainly, I mean, I think that there are lots of young English players who people are excited to see as well. Like Holgate, Calvert-Lewin. Well,
Calvert-Lewin looks very good every time I see
him. Yeah, he's incredibly lively. You know, they had Lookman on the bench. I thought Keane was good in times, although I think that there were moments when Aguero or Gabriel was running one-on-one against Keane where Keane just looked like he wasn't quite sharp enough for it, but I presume that will come. People do like to see that. And as Miguel touched on earlier, I think what's been really impressive with Everton the first two games is not even just Rooney's two goals, but Rooney's all-round play. Yeah. Like, I was at a few of Rooney's last games for Manchester United at the back end of last year, a game which they lost at Tottenham and a game which they lost at Arsenal. And both those games, Rooney was useless.
Like, there were genuinely times you saw Rooney, can he trap a ball anymore?
Yeah, his touch had gone, he was slow, he was sluggish, he was off the pace. And that was the moment when I thought, you know, you should get on the phone to Shanghai SIPG. Yeah. But in fact...
Very specific.
Yeah, like, but now he's really good. Like, he's touch is back, he's really clear. It's like watching Rooney from 5 years ago. Like, he's half a step ahead of everyone else.
I think you have to give him huge credit. I mean, clearly his pride was hurt by what's gone on in the last 2 years, particularly the last year, even I suppose getting dropped from United. But to actually again affect it in such a way is usually, and even to go back, I mean, because back in February, we reported he was going to go to Everton in the first place. I mean, that at that stage of his career, that is really brave, or not brave, but it's just really credible. Given so many other players, given when they've achieved as much as him, would have taken the easy option, taken the money. Now, it's not that Everton aren't paying him well, but to really get back into that fight, I think he deserves huge respect for it.
Yeah, you leave yourself quite exposed going there because everyone can see you every week. And then if you're not in the team, then all of a sudden, you know, not getting the Everton team is different from not getting the Manchester United team. But now, I mean, if he can, you know, admittedly we're 2 Premier League games into the season, but he's played in Europe too. If he can keep playing like this, then why shouldn't he get back in the England squad ahead of the World Cup next year?
I think his long-range passing in particular. Yeah. And I've seen that a few times where you think he can really pick a long range pass. He's got the great vision, but he can execute it as well. So I wonder, you know, David Moyes kind of failed to use him that deeper role.
Yeah.
With the arrival of Sigurdsson and also the fact that Klaassen's there and Sandro dropping deep and all these things, I wonder if they might change how they use him. But so far, I've been very impressed.
Yeah. Although, let's not forget, actually, both of his goals so far were one touch finishes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No,
which speaks to that sharpness as well.
I don't think he can be a midfielder. Mm. I've never seen him play midfield well for England or for United. I think that his best off is probably, if he can't quite be a penalty box poacher, maybe as a kind of second striker off Sandro. Even although, admittedly, that is harder to figure out how that would work with Sigurdsson coming in.
Yeah.
But I think if he's sufficiently sharp enough to be effective in the box, which has been the evidence so far, that is probably where his main usefulness will be.
And just before we leave Man City, Everton, Miguel, do you have anything else to add?
Well, it was a very eventful match, but then to only add to it, I had to teeter and spectacle, was kind of more passive aggressive emotion from Guardiola. It's something that's kind of increasingly difficult to avoid. And to be honest, kind of just have a few issues with it. I mean, he seems to have taken on this kind of crusade against the, not crusade, but he seems to have this complex to media. Now, whether that's justifiable or not, whether there's aspects of the British press or British, the way questions are asked, you know, fair enough. But it's the level he goes to now. And
What's his issue specifically with the media?
his main issue, basically, I think, seems to be that he doesn't like getting questioned the fact that he's not winning as many games either at Barcelona or Bayern. I think that's what it ultimately comes down to. It's difficult to get away from that because he was never this bad in Spain. He was never this bad in Germany. And aspects of the Spanish press could be kind of even more, I'd say, more invasive than England in that way. So it is, it is difficult not to pin it down to kind of just a narkiness. The fact that things aren't going the way he expected them to.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting because you know if City win and play well, he can be such a fascinating person to listen to in a press conference, and he talks about football in a way which is, I mean, I've genuinely never heard anyone talk about football in public like that.
Agreed.
You kind of it's an education to hear him explaining things, although you often miss it because he's explaining things at, you know, 200 words a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're not quite picking up the nuances of what he's getting at. But on the other hand, like when City lose or if he's upset about something, like the rudeness, the sarcasm, the insincerity.
And the thing is, he can complain about some of the questions, but some of those questions that he doesn't like come because of the fact that he's completely blanked a relevant issue. Like if he's not willing to discuss Kyle Walker or a miss, then it's only natural that the interviewer kind of will, okay, well, let's go on to the next subject. I mean, you know, one of the reasons he's at Man City on this is because of international broadcasting. So this is the other side of the deal.
So, you know, he's a bit surly. He's a bit moody, especially after they lose. How different is that to Jose Mourinho?
Well, I think with Mourinho, like...
They're two sides of the same coin, I think.
I do think that with Mourinho, like, yeah, he says some kind of surprising stuff a lot of the time, and he can be quite unpleasant and also, like Guardiola, quite insincere. But with Mourinho, there is this kind of like playfulness or sense of theatre, which certainly from the media perspective, and I think probably from a viewer's and reader's perspective as well, is entertaining. Like he does, you know, he's willing to call people out at press conferences or, you know, choose a set the back page agenda with some bar.
Actually,
and it's funny. Like he is a funny, entertaining, engaging man, or at least he's capable of being those things when he's in the right mood. Whereas with Guardiola, there's none of that kind of sense of theatre at all. I feel like he feels like he just doesn't really want to get stuck in.
That is one grand difference with Mourinho. I think Mourinho, for him, every single press conference, every single media engagement becomes part of the game. Whereas Guardiola is like, I can't be bothered with this. Like, he's got bigger things to think about because something's gone wrong with his team. But even in relation to that, there were times with Mourinho as well when he was kind of just in a Chelsea, remember, and he was in kind of a fairly neutral mood, and you'd ask him some kind of general football question. Actually, I remember one of the best press conferences, like it was an education. It was Mourinho talking about Messi and how to stop Messi and what he can. 2 days after Messi basically beat Bayern 3-0 in the Champions League
2015.
That time. Yeah, he was amazing that day. But then even when Mourinho's not up for it, that becomes like when he's, you know, stonecalling the press and all that, that becomes part of the part of the performance as well. Whereas Guardiola is just his approach is
Yeah, like ultimately, Jose does like being in the media. Like he likes being on the back pages. He likes being on telly, and he likes the performance of it. Mm. Whereas you always think with Pep, he thinks, you know, why should I have to explain my tactics to people who don't understand 2% of what I understand about football? I don't know if that's literally what he thinks, but that's certainly like the impression that sometimes you get from listening to him talk.
He certainly comes across occasionally as if he's not really enjoying himself over here, which is one of the main things we're yet to see. I think the fun side of Guardiola.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how that one develops. We've just got to skirt over some of the rest of these Premier League results. Southampton beat West Ham 3-2. That was a stoppage time penalty from Charlie Austin, but Chicharito had scored twice in the first half. He scored twice, not in the first half. In the first half, Marko Arnautovic was sent off. Did you see that, Miguel?
I did, actually.
It was a fairly terrible elbow. The new signing, £25 million, tipped by someone in this room to be the flop of the year. I believe, and not a good start. He got a 0 out of 10 in one newspaper I saw. But Chicharito's two goals, did you know that all 38 of his Premier League goals have come within the penalty area?
I did not.
That's probably doesn't surprise you, but it's interesting that he literally can't score from outside the penalty area. Southampton with the 3-2 win, they actually hadn't scored, I believe, a home goal for 9 hours of football in the league. So Southampton are back on track. They actually look like, I think, a half-decent side. Manolo Gagliardini is a handy player. Leicester beat Brighton 2-0. Brighton struggling a little bit at the start, but they really rate this Colombian winger they've just signed, Jose Luis Izquierdo, who they think could be one of the best wingers in the world. So follow that one closely. And Bournemouth 0, Watford 2. Richarlison gets his first goal since arriving from Brazil. And Etienne Capoue continues his weird goal-scoring streak.
Yeah, I mean, I think Richarlison's going to be a really exciting signing for Watford. The big issue before the start of the season at Watford was that they didn't have any pace in behind. Like they only had one proper striker, Troy Deeney, and he was injured. But in the last few days, signing Richarlison and Andre Gray, they've got so much pace in behind now. Andre Gray is basically like a better, quicker, more mobile Deeney. And all of a sudden, you can see they do have the pieces in place to play the 4-3-3 that Marco Silva wants. And I think they'll be fine this season.
He's a good coach, and I still think Watford could be the... Of any of that mid-table gaggle of teams, I think they could be the team that cracks the top half this season.
I notice one result was left out there, Ed. Skipped over, was it? Some South London club.
Yeah. Oh no!
Dutch Hamlet.
I actually didn't. I didn't note down the goal scorers from that. I remember it was Sadio Mane that scored the winner. Yeah, Sadio Mane scored the winner as Liverpool beat Crystal Palace 1-0 at Anfield, a second half winner. Frank de Boer has started 0 from 2. He's now the favourite to be the first Premier League manager to leave. Miguel, are you happy with that?
There we go. Yeah.
Is there any thoughts on Liverpool knocking off a simple win?
I suppose good week for them all round. And Coutinho looks like he's going to stay.
What I would say is this is a really hard time this season if you're playing that Champions League playoff game, because you're trying to get up to speed in the Premier League while also playing two massive games, which are quite difficult.
To have games that are that momentous at this point when you're not really feeling the season.
Wenger has always blamed the 8-2 against Manchester United in 2011 on the fact they just played two legs against Udinese.
Yeah,
Champions League playoff. It's really, really like if you get an easy team, you can get through it. But if you get a hard team, it's hard.
But the first leg against Hoffenheim puts Liverpool in a great spot in the Champions League. We will be talking about potential Champions League groups later. First, I want to go to Spain. Mm-hmm. La Liga, which got kicked off over the weekend. Real Madrid and Barcelona obviously starting off as they always do. Atletico Madrid disappointed 2-2 draw at Girona. How do we see this season, just on a wider kind of La Liga glance, I guess? Do we think Real Madrid might actually just pull away and make it a one-team sort of title race this year?
Unless Barca bring in essentially a new spine, a centre-half, attack midfielder, and a forward, then yes, basically. Because there's such a gap between this. I mean, and the squad, it's not even about the first 11 at that level with these two teams. It's about, and although actually there is now, since Neymar's gone.
There's a
gulf in that now as well. So there's a gulf, both in terms of the 11 and the squad. So if Barca don't address that, it could be a very difficult season. But they could be looking at a... It's quite an interesting inversion, given that just half a decade ago we were talking of Barca being the new like in the same way that Real Madrid were identified with the old European Cup because the amount of times they won it and because of the history they created and the sparkle of it all, that Barca were that to the modern Champions League. But already so quickly Real Madrid could completely change that.
It's unbelievable, really. I mean, last season the difference between the two teams was the depth rather than the first 11s were virtually identical
as Barca proved in the last Clásico.
But what we had was one bench at Real Madrid, which was happy, really. I mean, they're all guys who they wanted to be playing, but they weren't unhappy that they were sat on the bench. And Barcelona brought in players like Andre Gomez, who were vastly overpaid and basically not good enough to step up to the level. And of all the players they bought last summer, you could basically say that Samuel Umtiti looks like he could be up to Barca level, but all of the other guys have not made it. And this summer's amazingly been worse for them, obviously losing Neymar. Jack, how are Barcelona going to go about this?
Well, I mean, clearly they need a kind of, you know, start from scratch, rebuilding on the similar to what they did back in 2003 when the Joan Laporta board first came in.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, that took, within 3 years they won the Champions League again. But they, I mean, it's so hard because we're not used to, I think, seeing like the decline of a great team to, you know, from winning the Champions League in 2015, at which point people were saying, is this even better than the Pep team? Are they going to be the first team to retain it? Which, of course, Real Madrid became. And, you know, just over 2 years on from then, they're now looking for, like, unimaginably far away from Real Madrid.
Yeah. And that's the thing, essentially, Barcelona's team, or sorry, Guardiola's 2008-2011 team, they're basically the peak of that cycle that started with Laporte in 2003. It wasn't like Guardiola kind of revolutionized everything again. It was more so he took them on another level after a little bit of a dip. But now it's as if it's gone full cycle, and they need a 2003 situation yet again.
Yeah, they do. They need clearly. I mean, the Rosé and Bartomeu board have basically destroyed what they were handed, and they need a new bunch of guys to come in and give them that kind of impetus and basically reimpose the right values, because clearly, you know, the pursuit of Neymar and big money glamour players ahead of everything else has completely destroyed everything that people worked so hard on.
Given the club used to value themselves such purism, there's been so many gaudy elements in the last few years as well, like right down to the kind of the sponsorships, the nature of the Neymar deal, everything, and even the fact that has just ended up with this humiliation, really, of having lost him.
Of course, from Mesquite club to a mess of a club.
Right.
thank you. Real Madrid and Barcelona are obviously top of their pots in the respective Champions League draw. That, you may have noticed, is a perfect segue into this. Looking ahead to Thursday, 6 p.m, an awful time for that to happen. The Europa League draw, if you're wondering, is Friday lunchtime. Pot 1, I'll just quickly run through, is Real Madrid, Bayern, Chelsea, Juventus, Benfica, Monaco, Spartak and Shakhtar. Pot 2, Barcelona, Atletico, PSG, Dortmund, Man City, Porto, Man United and likely Sevilla. Pot 3 is Tottenham, Basel, Roma, Anderlecht, Besiktas and likely Napoli, Olympiacos and Liverpool too. And I won't go through Pot 4 because they're much harder to pronounce. But Miguel, looking at those, the interesting thing for me is just how bad it could get for one of the English teams.
Yeah.
But at the other end, it's really easy. So what would you say is the hardest draw for Tottenham and Liverpool, for example? Yeah. They're going to be in Pot 3.
Because they get there, there's the danger of them getting two of the really, really big. I mean, I suppose
Juventus, Barcelona, Tottenham, Leipzig is a possible group. That's got to be the worst case scenario, possibly.
Yeah, that is a horror show.
but equally, they could get Spartak Moscow, Porto, Tottenham, and then Apoel or Steaua Bucharest. The things look far better for them that way. What do you think would be the most interesting matchups, Jack, in the group stage?
Well, I think a lot of people would love to see Tottenham against Atletico Madrid, which of course we could get because of the similarities there between Pochettino and Diego Simeone.
Well, actually, there's an interesting, it's because one of the problems with the recent Champions League has been how often we see the same fixtures.
Exactly, like,
so
yeah.
Barca, PSG, Arsenal, PSG, say all of Arsenal,
Chelsea, PSG.
So I mean, just even some of the fixtures here we've either never seen or have rarely seen. I mean, one is unfortunately they can't get each other, but it's amazing that actually Chelsea and Real Madrid have never met in the Champions League.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Just looking at like potential ties we could get here, that would be like that.
Mm.
I mean, you could have. I mean, Man United against Juventus is not a game that we've seen for a while.
I was actually thinking that. Also,
Man United
against
Juve would be terrific.
I'd love to do a piece on the rivalry in the 90s.
Yeah. No, Manchester United versus Juventus would be good. The thing is, what you want is the group stages for these super clubs really are almost a cakewalk still.
Yeah.
I understand what Michel Platini was trying to do.
But the nature is there is still always one group, just because there's almost too many teams for the top two, that there's always one group that engages.
Platini tried to get all the champions in there, which I think is a good thing broadly for European football. However, it does mean you do get some heavyweight groups paired with some smaller sides. But I agree. I think Manchester United versus Juventus would be an interesting one because it's one we've not seen for quite a while. I'd quite like to see maybe Bayern Munich versus PSG. I think they could both dominate their leagues this season by a distance. So to see them against each other. What do you think? Liverpool against someone like Atletico Madrid or even Barcelona, if you're bearing in mind what's happened in the off-season.
Yeah, give us plenty to write about.
And also, you know, you've got Leipzig there who could get Liverpool, which would be fun for Naby Keita reasons.
If Liverpool played Barcelona and Coutinho scored at the Nou Camp, he could do the fantastic thing of refusing to celebrate a goal scored against a team he wanted to join, which I think was last seen by, I think, Robert Snodgrass did it.
Great respect.
Yeah.
Great respect.
I believe that comes under hashtag a touch of class.
Yeah.
And much, to be honest, most of our podcast does as well. That probably wraps up this week's
beautiful outro
edition. Today, you may notice we were a day late. We had a slight studio issue. Next week, because of the bank holiday, we will also be out on Tuesday. But thank you nonetheless for listening. Please continue to subscribe and listen and review us in great numbers, which we have been. We will have the extra questions from listeners next week. So if you chuck those into your iTunes review, I guarantee you that we will get round to them. If not, then tweet us at IndieFootball, at Miguel Delaney, at Jack Pitbrook. And we will get back to you. So thank you again for joining us. This has been Miguel Delaney.
Oh, thank you.
This has been Jack Pitbrook.
Thank you very much.
I've been Ed Mallion, and this has been the Indie Football Podcast. Thank you very much.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.